We're looking at chapter 9, the penultimate chapter of The Lonely Man of Faith by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva. In our concluding sessions, our long trek through The Lonely Man of Faith. Chapter 9 is a bit long, and it's very important, because either it's parenthetical to the whole discussion, or it's the pinnacle of the whole discussion, depending on how you look at it. After we finish it, I'd be curious as to your thoughts on how this chapter fits in with the rest. Until now, Rabbi Soloveitchik had been describing the first seven chapters or so. He had been describing these two typological characters, Adam the First and Adam the Second. I trust by now you know, like the back of your hand, who these two folks are, and you'd be able to recognize them. Chapter 8, he kind of stepped out of those typological discussions of who these two figures are, what they do, what their characteristics are like, their role in the world, etc. And he explained, of course, there is no Adam 1, there is no Adam 2, there are two different components of each and every person, although, to be clear, not every person has a proper balance between the two of them. Now, in chapter 9, he's going to try to explore going back to this idea of the duality. And it's even in the last chapter, he made this large argument for monism, unity, that really it's all one. And just as a kind of thought experiment, we were talking about them as if they were two distinct personalities. But really, they're both components of each and every one of us. Now he's going to go back and try to understand why the man of faith is in such a precarious position in the modern world. Now, again, by the modern world, he's talking about the United States in the 1960s. Some of that reality has changed quite a great deal. And in other ways, what he's writing about is just as true for us today. And I'll leave that to you to try to pick out how what he's saying here is still the case and how a little bit it's no longer the case. The challenge of being a man of faith in the modern world. So until now, he was discussing a kind of pristine ideal. And now, in chapter 9, he's asking practical questions of what, you know, what does it all mean for us today? But because of that, he goes back to this notion of the dualism of these two, you know, we've put the personality back into the centrifuge and separated them out into the contingent parts of Adam the First, majestic man, and Adam the Second, covenantal man. While the ontological, I'm going to skip around a little bit so that we can try to get through almost all of the chapter tonight, if not the whole thing. While the ontological loneliness, the loneliness rooted in being, which is of the man of faith, is due to a God-made and willed situation and is, as part of his destiny, a wholesome and integrating experience. The loneliness that we've been describing of Adam the Second until now, that's built into creation. That's built into the way God willed the man of faith to be. And that loneliness, that sense of uniqueness, of being alone, of being unlike everyone else, and because of that, the challenge of forming community and communicating with others and even with God is a challenge that has to be overcome. That's not a bad thing. It's built into creation. It's part of our destiny. It's that's not a bad thing. But the Rav says, a special kind of loneliness of the contemporary man of faith, referred to at the beginning of the essay, is of a social nature due to a man-made historical situation and is hence an unwholesome and frustrating experience. There's another type of loneliness. There's another type of isolation, which is not built into creation, which is not definitional to the ontology, to the being of being a man of faith, but is a byproduct of contemporary reality. It's socially constructed. And that's not something wholesome, and it's not something positive, it's something frustrating. Let me diagnose the situation in a few terse sentences. Contemporary Adam the First, majestic man, extremely successful in his cosmic majestic enterprise, refuses to pay earnest heed to the duality in man and tries to deny the undeniable, that another Adam exists beside, or rather in him. The contemporary Adam the First tries to ignore that Adam the Second is part of him, that he has this, the majestic man tries to forget the fact that he has the man of faith as part of his personality. Right? He tries to climb back into the centrifuge and to live as if he could separate these two components of his personality, which of course can't be done. We can suppress aspects of our personality. We can try behavioral modifications, but it is who we are. By rejecting Adam the Second, by rejecting the man of faith, contemporary man, eo ipso, in and of itself, dismisses the covenantal faith community as something superfluous and obsolete. So the Rav is saying that contemporary modern man is trying to do away with the covenant of faith, which is not to say, as he will in a few pages, that he's an atheist, which is not to say that he's not a religious person. But there's a difference between being a religious person and being a member of the covenant of faith. To clear up any misunderstanding on the part of my audience, I wish to note that I am not concerned in this essay with a vulgar and illiterate atheism professed and propagated in the most ugly fashion by a natural political community which denies the unique transcendental worth of the human personality. Now again, essays written in the mid-1960s, he's speaking, and we saw this quite a bit more at the beginning of the essay, where there's actually a degree of polemic against communism. I tried to tease out in some of our earlier talks on how that's evident in the essay. But here, he may be talking about that, the atheism of Soviet Russia. But he may also be talking about contemporary American culture and the rise of an anti-religious or a non-religious ethos that was on the rise in mid-century America. I'm referring rather to Western man who is affiliated with organized religion. The Adam the First that he's talking about is not an atheist. He is a shulgoer. He is a churchgoer. And again, I remind you, the original iteration of the talks that evolved into this essay were delivered in front of a Catholic audience. So the man of faith who rejects the covenantal community, who rejects the part of him which is the modern man who rejects the covenantal community, who rejects the part of him who is the lonely man of faith, he himself is a member in a synagogue and a member in a church, and he's a generous supporter of its institutions. He stands today in danger of losing his dialectical awareness and of abandoning completely the metaphysical polarity implanted in man as a member of both the majestic, that is Adam the First, and the covenantal, that is Adam the Second, communities. Because the modern man, even though he may be a religious man, he cannot be a member of the community of faith, this larger covenantal community, because he's broken down that dialectic The two sides of his personality are not in communication with each other. And now the Rav is going to try to describe why each needs the other. Why Adam the first needs Adam the second. Somehow man of majesty considers the dialectical awareness too great a burden. It's a lot of work. It demands a lot. Interfering with his pursuit of happiness and success, and is therefore ready to cast it off. Let us try to describe, in brief, the philosophy by which a successful Western man is guided in his appraisal of the transcendental commitment. I said a while ago that I'm speaking of Western man who belongs I'm not sure. Anna asks if this solitude or the breakdown of the dialectic is a consequence of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. I'm not sure. There's no reference at all here to the Holocaust, although in a few moments we'll see maybe there's a hint at something, but it may just as well be a hint at the fears of nuclear apocalypse that were so prevalent in the mid-1960s. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I said a while ago that I'm speaking of Western man who belongs and extends help to some religious establishment. Nevertheless, no matter how conscientious and devoted a fellow member he is, he belongs not to the covenantal faith community, this shul-going or church-going contemporary Adam the First. Being a shul member does not make you a member of the covenantal community, but to a religious community, and they're not the same. The two communities are as far apart as the two atoms. Remember, what kind of community does Adam the First form? Please, somebody, help me not go out of my mind that after all these many hours together, somebody can answer this. What kind of community does Adam the First form? If you can't answer this question, you have not been investing your time wisely. No. Adam the First, majestic man, forms community in order to correct. It's a pragmatic relationship. Adam the First, v'kivshuha, conquer the world, domesticate the world, subdue nature, forms community, even though in principle, I've said this many times, in principle, he could be a Robinson Crusoe. He doesn't have any real inherent psychic need for other people. But there's a practical need. That together we might accomplish more than any one of us could do alone. So it's very pragmatic oriented. Rabbi Soloveitchik called it the natural work community. To get things done. Adam the First can form religious communities. Right? That we can come together. Religious communities do all types of very practical things, like social welfare and feeding the poor and the hungry, which is something that that people beyond the moral ethical imperative might feel it's necessary to do. You might, if you have a notion of davening with a minion, right? So you need to get 9 other people to show up so that you can accomplish that goal. The two communities are as far apart as the two atoms. While the covenantal faith community, that of Adam the Second, is governed, as I emphasized, by a desire for a redeemed existence, the religious community, the practical, pragmatically oriented religious community of Adam the First, which is not redemption-oriented per se, is dedicated to the attainment of dignity and success. Remember, the search for dignity is what drives Adam the First, and is, along with the whole gamut of communities, such as the political community, the scientific community, the artistic community, a creation of Adam the First, all conforming to the same sociological structural patterns. The religious community is therefore also a work community, consisting of two grammatical personae, not including the third person, I and thou, but it's not necessarily God himself is not a member of that community, as he is in the covenantal faith community of Adam the Second. The man who values religion in terms of its usefulness to him and considers the religious act a medium through which he may increase his happiness, the family that prays together stays together. He doesn't refer to it, but that's obviously what he's talking about. That kind of, that marketing jingle that somebody came up with in, you know, probably in the 1950s, 1960s America, that religion gives you all the answers, or gives you many of the answers, to the social ills facing, the American family. Religious families suffer less divorce. Religious children are less liable to become involved in drugs and other unsavory things. So come to church because it will, you know, help you avoid all of those problems. Now, those in of themselves are not bad things. Those in and of themselves are not bad things, but that's has nothing to do with the covenantal faith community of Adam the Second leaving the isolation of his loneliness in order to form covenant with fellow man and with God himself as a member of that relationship. And again, the lengthy discussion in chapter 7 about prayer as a kind of a denominator of those of that community. The assumption on the part of Majestic Man about the role of religion is not completely wrong. If only, as I shall explain, he would recognize also the non-pragmatic aspects of religion. The Rav does not, Rabbi Soloveitchik, does not deny the practical benefits to organized religion. But he says, don't confuse the Ikar and the Tafel. Don't confuse the essence with the side effects. We're not opposed to religious life being a healthy life. We're not opposed to the idea of the practical, natural work community being something from which people gain strength and support. We're not opposed to the idea of two people sharing a cab, the example I've used time and time again. But that's not the goal of religious life. And the Rav here is making a critique on mid-century, the kind of Madison Avenue marketing of mid-century America. It's a critique on the Protestant denominations, but it's also a critique on the degrees to which those ideas seeped into Jewish life, both through the so-called liberal denominations, the conservative and reform movement, but also into the world of Orthodoxy. And this was something that he felt we needed to call people out on the carpet about. I'm going to skip ahead here in the top of page 89. The Rav is exploring this idea of why Adam the First needs Adam the Second. To be sure, man can build spaceships capable of reaching other planets without addressing himself to the mystery of faith, and without being awakened to an enhanced, inspired life which reflects the covenantal truth. Now, he makes this point that, again, the idea that we saw so much at the beginning of the essay, and so much a a product of the zeitgeist of the spirit of the times in the 1960s, the space race, that this idea that v'kivshuha, that man has to, Adam the First has to conquer the world, he has to subjugate the world, and the scientific quest and exploration and that those were all things that were components of the life of Adam the first. So Vakasha, we can land someone on the moon. But it can be done without an awareness that you're doing it as part of being a member in the covenantal faith community. It can be done without God awareness. And that was actually one of the critiques. The Rav did not share in it, but one of the critiques from within the religious society about the, you know, in the 1960s, there was this kind of debate about the propriety of investing hundreds of millions of dollars in the space race when there were people in the United States that were going hungry, when there were people in the United States that weren't being educated. Right? Why are we trying to get to the moon when we have so many problems down here? So the Rav thought that, you know, obviously we have to solve the problems down here, but the exploration of space in and of itself is a positive thing, because it's part of that, the imperative of of Adam the First. It's part of v'kivshuha. But from within the religious quarter, both Jewish and Gentile, there were voices of dissent against space exploration on theological grounds, on ideological grounds, on pragmatic grounds. But it was clear that the race into space was not necessarily, not automatically, in and of itself, eo ipso, something which was advancing the covenantal imperatives, even though it could. It had that potential. Successful man wants to be a sovereign. Adam the First wants to be a sovereign, not only in the physical, but also in the spiritual world. He's questing not only for material success, but for ideological, axiological achievements as well. He's concerned with the philosophy of nature and man, of matter and mind, of things and ideas. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here, the top of page 91. In like manner, the worth and validity of the ethical norm, if it is born of the finite creative social gesture of Adam the First, cannot be upheld. Only the sanctioning by a higher moral will is capable of lending to the norm fixity, permanence, and worth. Without Adam the First is a moral fellow, he's an ethical fellow, but that old critique of humanistic ethics, unless it's rooted in a covenantal commitment, a divine imperative, it's always going to be a little bit slippery. Avraham's answer to Avimelech, Rak ein yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh. Avimelech says to Avraham, why did you lie to me? Or why did you tell me that Sarah was your sister? Why did you think that I was going to kill you so that I could take your wife? Right, it's a reasonable question. So Avraham says, I saw that there's no fear of God in this place. And even though you might be a scientific society, an advanced society, even a society that has morals and values and ethics, if it's not rooted in some larger commitment and some larger set of principles, it's always going to be relativized. And, you know, the Malbim makes this point in the Chumash on that place. And there's certainly no better example than Nazi Germany, where, and here there might be, Anna, you asked about the Holocaust, there might be an echo of that here, either consciously or subconsciously. Nazi Germany was the most civilized, advanced society in the world up to that point. The arts, science, math, medicine, literature, music, etc. The same society was able to to rationalize and justify the most horrific crimes committed in the history of mankind. So that kind of the slippery ethics. So Adam the First is suspect of that, unless there can be the dialogue between Adam the First and Adam the Second, which causes that rootedness in a larger set of covenantal principles. Only the sanctioning by Hamor, letting the norm. Likewise, majestic man, Adam the First, is quite often in need of the redemptive and therapeutic powers inherent in the act of believing, which in times of crisis may give aid and comfort to the distressed mind. So here's a very pragmatic benefit of being a member of the covenantal faith community. Faith is a very, very powerful thing, and it gives us strength and comfort in times of need. That's not illegitimate. It's not the purpose of religion, but it's clearly a benefit of being a member of the faith community. So that's something that even Adam the First needs. So without being plugged in, if you're Adam the First and you're Adam the Second are not connected, if there's a disconnect in your personality, if you've suppressed your Adam the Second, you're not going to have access to those benefits. For good reason did the thinkers throughout the centuries speak of philosophical religion, which emanates from the deep recesses of the human personality. They knew very well that the human, creative, cultural gesture is incomplete if it does not relate itself to a higher modus existenti, the mode of existence, the level of existence of Adam the Second. No wonder that the Kantian and Neo-Kantian philosophies, scientific and empirical as they were, let the creative cultural consciousness pick out from the flow of transient impressions, abstract constructs and ideas, those bits that point towards the infinite and internal. From these elements, they tried to construct a pure rational religious awareness in order to endow the whole creative gesture with intrinsic worth and with ultimate and unconditioned validity. Since majestic man is in need of a transcendental experience in order to strengthen his cultural edifice, it is the duty of the man of faith to provide him with some component parts of this experience. Adam the Second has a responsibility to Adam the First. If Adam the Second, if that part of the human personality can't lend to the scientist, if the man of spirit in your personality, you know, think of like the old Bugs Bunny cartoons, you know, the angel and the devil sitting on each shoulder battling it out, right? So the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Hatov, obviously these are not two different parts. We are all one. We are one person. But when we imagine the different sides of our personalities battling it out, if our Adam the Second can't offer that to Adam the First, if the scientist in us, if the pragmatist in us can't draw on the support of the man of faith in us, the person of faith in us, the member of the covenant in us, to add the experiential, transcendental experience, so then, you know, the science is useless. God would not have implanted the necessity in majestic man for such spiritual perceptions and ideas if he had not at the same time endowed the man of faith with the skill of converting some of his apocalyptic experiences, which are metalogical and non-hedonic, into a system of values and verities comprehensible to majestic man. In other words, if the man of faith can't communicate the meta logic, the experience that goes beyond logic, beyond pure rationalism, the non-hedonic, the non-corporeal, the spiritual experience, the apocalyptic experience, that awareness of being pointed to something greater and beyond us, to a goal at the end of days, both personal and national, if the faith component in us can't communicate that to the pragmatic, majestic component in us, so then Adam II is failing in his task. You point to a section like this, and you understand why Rabbi Soloveitchik is the hero of what modern Orthodoxy aspires to. We don't always achieve it. But this idea that our faith is meant to inform our engagement in the world. It's meant to inform our objective examination of the world. It's meant to inform our science and our art and our politics and everything that we do in the this worldly. And if it can't transform into a system of values and verities meaning truths, comprehensible to the majestic man, the experimenter, the estate, and above all, the creative mind, then something is wrong. At this point, however, the crisis in the relations between the man of faith and the majestic man begins to develop. The breakdown in the personality. If the job translating faith mysteries into cultural aspects could be fully accomplished, then contemporary man of faith would free himself, if not from the ontological awareness, which is perennial, then at least from the peculiar feeling of psychological loneliness and anguish, which is due to his historical confrontation with the man of culture. Adam I, the man of culture here. This is, in other words, if the two could communicate so easily, so then Adam II might not be so lonely in the contemporary, not lonely, not the existential loneliness we were talking about, but this idea that he introduced now that Adam II in the contemporary world is lonely in the sense of being ignored. Right? There's the loneliness we were talking about until now where you're lonely because you realize that there's something unique about you, there's a wall around you that can't ever be fully surmounted. And then there's the loneliness of you know, the person sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring. Lonely in the colloquial sense. So he says, what's the problem? Adam II is lonely in the colloquial sense because in the modern world, who needs faith? Isn't science, aesthetics, culture, aren't these islands unto themselves? The man of faith would, if this illusion came true, be at peace with the man of culture, so that the latter would fully understand the significance of human dialectics, and a perfect harmonious relationship would prevail between both atoms. But unfortunately, it doesn't in the modern world. And more, Adam II is being isolated, he's being relegated, he's being pushed aside. However, this harmony can never be attained, since the man of faith is not the compromising type. Right? Then this idea that, well, religion would have a lot more to offer to the contemporary world if it would be a little more accommodating, if it would be a little more compromising, if it would be more updated. So Rabbi Soloveitchik says that's not possible. Because faith, and again, remember, he's initially speaking to, not to a Jewish audience, and it's that way in which the religious experience, that there are commonalities amongst all of them, that a religious faith community can't be compromising. It can't be Madison Avenued to be jazzy, to offer something to the whole world. It can try to speak in the modern metaphor. It can try to communicate its idea with dignity, so that the world will take note, will heed the eternal message. But it can't compromise itself. So the harmony that would be obtained if Adam II would kind of come along and play ball with Adam I, can't be attained, since the man of faith is not the compromising type, and his covenantal commitment eludes cognitive analysis by the logos, by logic, by rationalism, and hence does not lend itself completely to the act of cultural translation. There's simply no cognitive categories in which the total commitment of the man of faith could be spelled out. This commitment is rooted not in one dimension, such as the rational one, but in the whole personality of the man of faith, the whole of the human being, the rational as well as the non-rational aspects of the commitment to God. And the Rav here is being very candid when he points out that there is something non-rational about the faith commitment, the faith covenant. Not irrational, but non-rational. Part of the existential, experiential component of religion can't be dissected in the laboratory. And the attempt to do so is mixing apples and pears. It takes the wrong diagnostic tools to try to, it just asks all of the wrong questions. C.S. Lewis has some place. C.S. Lewis has a very little volume called A Grief Observed, which is not directly related to our topic in The Lonely Man of Faith. It's more about the question of suffering and grief. And it was like a journal. It was journal entries that he kept to himself after his wife died. Like his own observations on grief. He's got a line there in a slightly different context where he says, are there questions that God can't answer? Right, so what would you say? Are there questions that God can't answer? Yes or no? No? Would you assume that there are questions that God can't answer? Tell me, what do you think? Yes or no? So that's like a typical response, Alan. No, we assume that there are no questions that God can answer any question. So Lewis says, no, there are plenty of questions God can't answer. Is red more square or more round? Is a cucumber more green or more long? Well, there are all types of questions that God can't answer because they're nonsense questions. No, it's not that answer that, you know, God answers, but we just don't always know what he's saying. No, a nonsense question can't be answered. And he says, probably most of our questions are like that. We just don't realize that they're nonsense questions. So the same thing here, like the attempt to analyze religion in a cognitive way is bringing all the wrong tools. It's asking all the wrong questions. You can't analyze it in that way. It's like, when neuroscience tries to show the biochemistry of love. It's not a very enlightening use of science's efforts and resources, because there are certain things that can't be put under a microscope. Of course, as long as the path of the man of faith cuts across the territory of the reasonable, the intellect may follow him and identify his footsteps. The very instant, however, that man of faith transcends the frontiers of the reasonable and enters into the realm of the unreasonable, which is part of the faith experience, the intellect is left behind and must terminate its search for understanding. The man of faith, animated by his great experience, is able to reach the point which not only his logic of the mind, but even his logic of the heart and of the will, everything, even his own eye awareness, has to give in to an absurd commitment. The man of faith is insanely committed to and madly in love with God. And here he's making reference to the Rambam at the end of the Hilchot Tshuvah, that the relationship to God is compared to a relationship of love. And even in the metaphor of the Rambam at the end of Hilchot Tshuvah to erotic love, which can't be, it can't be analyzed in a laboratory. It's that lovesickness, it's that sense of being, and here he brings this this pasuk from Shir HaShirim, which is of course the metaphor for the love between the Jewish people and God. You know, that sense of being wholly consumed. You can't rationalize that. And the attempt by science or the social sciences, either the hard sciences or the social sciences, to try to examine love and is not very insightful. It doesn't offer anything, right? It doesn't help the lovesick person to understand his experience any better. The untranslatability of the complete faith experience is due not to the weakness, but to the greatness of the latter. It's not a flaw in the religious experience that it can't ever be fully understood on the rational plane. It's a sign of the greatness of the experience. And that's a mistake. And here he's pointing out something that still does plague the modern world, but it was certainly true in 1965. This idea that if you can't explain it in scientific terms, then it means that it's probably flawed, or it's not real, or it's ephemeral, or etc. That was an assumption. That's an assumption that's made by the scientific community. But who says that that's correct? Maybe the fact that we can never fully explain it, that we can never fully communicate it, that we can't, it's untranslatable, that there's certain things that you can't express to someone who's not a partner to it. Maybe that's a sign of its greatness, of its strength. Here on page 96, he goes back again to the idea of therefore what prayer is and how prayer functions and what it accomplishes on, you know, to Adam the first on the social plane and Adam the second on the experiential plane. In a word, the message, here at the bottom of page 96, the message of translated religion is not the only one which the man of faith must address to majestic man of culture. Besides this message, man of faith must bring to the attention of the man of culture the kerygma, the bsurah, the proclamation of the religious truth of an original faith in all its singularity and pristine purity, in spite of the incompatibility of this message with the fundamental credo of the utilitarian society. It's true that we insiders to the faith experience of Adam II, you can never fully explain it to someone on the outside, even though we have an obligation to attempt to do so. How staggering this incompatibility is. This unique message speaks of defeat instead of success, of accepting a higher will instead of commanding, of giving instead of conquering, of retreating instead of advancing, of acting irrationally instead of being always reasonable. All of those things which are values to the modern society, which is the motto of Adam the First, V'kivshua, to conquer, to dominate, to understand, to rationalize, to bring logic. That's the opposite of the experience of Adam the Second. Adam the Second says there are things that we can't conquer. There are times we have to surrender. There's an essay, I hope that next semester in this same time and slot, we'll read some of Rabbi Soloveitchik's other essays, including a beautiful essay called Catharsis. I've made mention of it in the past, which talks about this idea that the religious experience is one of surrender. There are times where we have to say that if we are servants of God, we surrender. We surrender. Not that we surrender our intellect, because we are also Adam the First. But there are times at the end of the day where we have to throw up our hands and say, whether we understand or not, that has no bearing on our fundamental prime faith commitments. That the irrational component of religion is foreign to the modern man. Here the tragic event occurs. Contemporary majestic man rejects his dialectical assignment, and with it, the man of faith. Because there's always going to be a ketzer, a short between Adam the Second's ability to communicate the faith experience to Adam the First. Adam the First is going to, he's going to hang up the phone. He's going to cause the disconnect, and he's going to reject the conversation between the two sides of his personality, and he's going to reject the true faith experience, the man of faith. He's going to bury his own Adam the Second. And the Rav says, look around, that's what's happened to the faith experience, even to religious people. He's not saying, I'm not talking about people that are disconnected from faith, disconnected from religion, disconnected from the church or from the synagogue. I'm talking about people who are on the inside, that they've suppressed their own Adams the Second. The situation has deteriorated considerably in the century, which has witnessed the greatest triumphs of majestic man in his drive for conquest. Majestic Adam has developed a demonic quality, and here, maybe Anna, here's the section that I thought you may be right. Maybe there is some kind of awareness of this being written, you know, just 20 years after the end of the Holocaust. Laying claim to unlimited power, alas, to infinity itself, his pride is almost boundless, imagination arrogant, and he aspires to complete and absolute control of everything. Indeed, like the men of old, he's engaged in constructing a tower whose apex should pierce heaven. Perhaps here he's talking more about the era of nuclear Holocaust and not European Jewish Holocaust. And even though, again, as I've said, he's generally favorable to space exploration, he points out that it can also become a symbol of everything that's wrong. Here in the middle of page 98, he seeks not the greatness found in sacrificial action, but in the convenience one discovers in a comfortable, serene state of mind. Right? Family prays together, stays together. Religion isn't there to torment you. It's meant to give you all the answers. You know, don't give me questions, give me those still waters by the green pastures. And again, I remind you of the lengthy footnote 4 of the halachic man with which we opened our discussion. Correct, Sherry. Very keen observation. That this man becomes, in his own eyes, omnipotent and omniscient, leaving no room for God. No room or no need. He's desirous of an aesthetic experience. Rather than a covenantal one, of a social ethos, rather than a divine imperative, in a word, he wants to find in faith what he cannot find in his laboratory or in the privacy of his luxurious home. His efforts are noble, yet he is not ready for genuine faith experience, which requires the giving of oneself unreservedly to God, who demands unconditional commitment, sacrifice, action, retreat. Western man diabolically insists on being successful. Alas, he wants to be successful, even in his adventure, with God. He's very practical, he's very pragmatic, and if religion can't provide, if religion is going to give him questions that have to be worked out instead of answers that are going to give him solutions, then it's not very practical. Here on the bottom of page 100, it is here that the dialogue between the man of faith and the man of culture, between Adam the Second and Adam the First, comes to an end. Modern Adam the Second, as soon as he finishes translating religion into the cultural vernacular and begins to talk the foreign language of faith, finds himself lonely and forsaken, misunderstood, at times even ridiculed by Adam the First, by himself. When the hour of estrangement strikes, the ordeal of man of faith begins, and he starts his withdrawal from society. And this is the tragedy, that the man of faith withdraws from society, when not only does he have so much to offer society, but he has an obligation to society. He has an obligation to Adam the First, no less than the obligation Adam the First has to Adam the Second. But because Adam the First has cut himself off, Adam the First feels that Adam the Second has nothing to offer in the pragmatic world. Adam the Second, the man of faith, begins to retreat. He returns, like Moses of old, to his solitary hiding and to the abode of loneliness. Yet the loneliness of contemporary man of faith is a special kind. He experiences not only ontological loneliness, the kind of loneliness which is built into creation, but also the social isolation, the unhealthy form of loneliness. And here, this is the two parts. Until now, we've been talking about loneliness not in this sense. But here, it's the loneliness of someone who has no one to talk to, who has so much to offer, but yet no one's interested in listening to him. Whenever he dares to deliver the genuine faith kerygma, whenever he can try to communicate the faith experience, no one's listening. This is both the destiny and the human historical situation of the man who keeps a rendezvous with eternity, and who, in spite of everything, continues tenaciously to bring the message of faith to majestic man. But yet, nevertheless, he keeps trying, he keeps calling. No one's answering the line, but Adam the Second is trying from his isolation to communicate with the world, to communicate with modern man, to communicate with majestic man, to communicate with Adam the First, with practical man. But there's a problem, and chapter 9 ends on this very pessimistic note about the breakdown, the divorce between Adam the First and Adam the Second, and Adam the Second's ability or inability to try to communicate the true, deep, profound, covenantal faith experience to his own Adam the First, and by extension, to modern society. Partially, but Sherry, that's a different discussion that the Rav has. Maybe we'll come to that next semester. The very, very short chapter 10, which we will look at next week in our concluding session, the very short chapter 10 tries to sum everything up, and we'll have to see if we end on the pessimistic note or if there is a way out. So we will conclude that next week with chapter 10. And again, after the break, we will continue by looking at some of Rabbi Soloveitchik's other shorter essays, many of which were written around the same time and have resonances with the larger themes that were explored here.